This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not burdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, not peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Well, to start us off, in a way, it's also continuing on looking inside and finding how this works and how we can find happiness in this life and how we can find meaning and contentment and everything else and all these wonderful qualities that make life worthwhile and so many opportunities we have to fill our daily life with quality moments. And this is a thing we discussed last time about how we build up this fortress, how we try to protect ourselves from the world. And this is a very rational thing to do. It's a very natural thing to do. In Buddhism, there's called the six sense bases, where sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, all the six senses, and how they're local at each point. So sights come into the eyes, sounds come into the ears, and so on. And it's constantly, constantly happening. And the mind is always trying to reconcile these, trying to piece it all together, try to make sense of things so we can function in the world. And that's perfectly good, because it's very, very difficult if we don't. And yet at the same time, it becomes so complicated. So much is happening. So many pressures, so many different ideas and things we have to sort out that we can't really handle them that well. And what we often do is we start to shut them down. We start to bury them. We start to ignore them. And so coming back to the present moment can be very, very difficult. And yet, that's really what the whole practice is about and how we relate to the present moment. Because the whole thing is, in order for us to be free of all this huge assembly of things, this huge thing we've built up, we have to be able to be a little bit calm, a little bit quieter. We need to calm down our mind because it's overburdened already. It's got the fight or flight response going crazy. It's sending us pain signals all the time that we have to deal with. And so what we do is we ignore it. We dissociate from it. We try to escape from it. We run away into all kinds of distractions and everything else. And dissociation can sometimes be that big sort of out-of-body kind of experience where it's get me away from this. But sometimes it's also just shut it down and let's just fall asleep. And many people, when they start meditating, that's the first thing they do is they start falling. They start falling asleep because it's their way to get away from all this. And so the best, most effective ways of doing this are actually at the foundation of the Buddhist practice. And those are the five precepts. Now, this might surprise people because the five precepts sound like, oh, yes, this is something we have to do and whatever. But the main point is that our mind is more or less running here, running there. Our body is trying to cope with everything. So many interactions, so much going on. When we start to keep the five precepts, that brings stability into the mind. It starts to become a bit more comfortable being in the present moment because we're not so likely to run off and do all this crazy stuff. The five precepts in that level are very empowering because it brings that stability. It brings that ability to say, no, I don't need to run off and do this and think about this and blah, blah, blah. I don't need to go crazy trying to sort out and fix the world. I can be more present and engaged and therefore far more effective in the world. And this is one of the interesting things is when people practice the five precepts, they're trying to do it because they're trying to avoid bad karma. They're trying to do it perfectly. They're trying to be perfectly virtuous and control their situation, when really it's not that at all. The five precepts is a form of self-respect. We have to get ourselves to the point when we can realize that we have to resolve this situation. And when the mind's running crazy and doing this, doing that, and the body's trying to get some comfort and try to get some relief, and it's running here and running there and getting exhausted in doing that, we have to get ourselves to the position when we can say, this is the most rational thing to do with our lives. And one of the best things to do with our lives is to come back to the present moment and keep the five precepts in that way. And what's fascinating is when we look at the early Buddhist texts, there's a sutta there, and unfortunately I have forgotten it, the name of it, but there's a sutta that the Buddha talks about that someone who keeps the five precepts is comfortable in any group of people. So whether they're dealing with the nobility, whether they're dealing with the ordinary working classes, whether they're dealing with merchants and business people and everybody, they're comfortable because they have nothing to fear. Because this is a deep, deep thing, is our mind is afraid of what we're going to do. The mind is afraid that we're going to run off and say this and do that and do something we're going to regret for the rest of our lives, or that we're going to be looking over our shoulder for the rest of our lives because we've hurt somebody or we've done something foolish. Bringing in that restraint, so to speak, is very calming to the mind. It's very settling. And at the same time, it brings us a sense, okay, we can do this. It brings a sense of confidence into the mind, a sense of empowerment, so to speak, which doesn't come from getting and having. It comes from self-confidence. And then when we start to do that, the mind goes, I can breathe a bit. I don't have to worry so much. Venerable Sampa's not going to run off and do something crazy again. Thank goodness for that. And because it's a bit more calm, it can be a bit more open. It can be more relaxed in the present moment, but more open to the bigger picture of stuff. And that's where it all starts to come together, because when we're more comfortable in our own body and skin, in our own mind, in our own life, we can meditate better, because we don't need to run away so much. Now, of course, this is a work in progress. It's not something you can do very, very quickly, because as many of us know deep inside, we've become so disconnected that dissociation is really the only way that we can manage it. Our heart and our head has become so separated and so acrimonious with each other that we're not able to deal with this. We're not able to relate to ourselves. So we have to build that good relationship inside. And that's where it becomes, it can seem daunting to people. It can kind of see, whoa, this is too much. Can't do this. This is too hard. We have to start somewhere. And it comes from reaching that point where we sort of say, not doing it is just more of the same. It's not going to fix anything. We need to take sort of appropriate action. We need to take a step forward and do something with our lives rather than just wasting our lives hoping that tomorrow enlightenment will come or tomorrow happiness will turn up. Tomorrow we'll win the lottery and we can live happy ever after or whatever. It doesn't happen. We need to get ourselves to that point where we can be very rational about things. And when I talk about the heart and the head, really I mean wisdom and compassion, the positive sides of these, because, you know, the heart can be pretty irrational at times, and the head can be pretty cold and ruthless at times, even heartless, we could say. So we have to look at those positive qualities. But we're more open to trying them. We're more open to see, what is it like to live a good life? What is it like to be a little bit more virtuous? What is it like to be a bit more generous, to be more self-forgiving, to live a good life? We start to be more open to the idea of maybe we can. And then we try it because we have that sense that why not? And then the mind gets even more calmer. It gets even more settled because just keeping the precepts is not it. The mind needs joy. The mind needs happiness. The reason it's running away is because everything is impermanent and out of control, because it's all unpleasant, because it's all changing and, you know, we can't control it. That's the whole reason it's running away and trying to control things. And it's never going to accomplish this. And yet at the same time, it can become more comfortable with that reality, that we can't fix maybe the bigger picture, but there's so much we can do with the here and now. There's so much we can do with our own life that can make us happier. And that can spread in a much broader sense. If we're happier, the people who are around us are happier. If we're miserable and bitter and angry and vengeful, well, they're not going to be very happy either. It's just natural. They don't want to be around us if we're in a bad state. It's completely to be expected. But when we're more happy and more calm within ourselves, people are drawn to being more calm and happy in themselves. And this is one of the most powerful symbols in Buddhism, is really the Buddha statue, that calm, serene figure. We just instantly, we recognize it straight away, that peaceful, serene calmness. The thing is, though, at this stage, we sort of think, oh, well, you know, you're a monk, whatever, you know, maybe you can live that life, but not us, we're so busy. Not necessarily so. Not necessarily. The thing is, we're so busy trying to get away with this. We've got such a bad relationship with ourselves. We have to start somewhere. We have to start bringing these things together. And that is very, very rewarding. And we need to have that feedback within ourselves where we see that it's rewarding. We see that it's worth doing. But at the same time, when we do this, it is a bit of a humbling experience because, and it's also challenging. And it's challenging because these signals that our body and mind have been sending us for so long, we just haven't been listening to them. And what they've had to do is they've had to start shouting and screaming at us, and we still stop listening to them. It's like we go away from the office for a couple of weeks and come back and our computer's full of emails and the desk is full of papers and all this stuff we have to sort out. And that can seem overwhelming and way too much for people. But we have to start to get ourselves to that point where, again, we say, this is worth doing. We have to start somewhere. Bring it on. And then we can start dealing with this and start, again, improving that relationship with ourselves so that our mind feels, okay, we can do this. Because this is the other thing. When the mind feels that we don't have the skills to do this, we're not listening, of course it's going to try and dissociate. Of course it's going to try and run away from us. And we turn ourselves into the enemy. And it doesn't have to be that way. But the challenge, of course, comes to see that this is so rewarding. But at the same time, it's humbling because we see that we're just a part in this much bigger thing. We have to tell our mind sometimes, calm down a bit, stop screaming at me, this is not so important. Because this is the thing, all these little needs and wants and everything else, they're basically screaming at us as if our life's about to end. So we have to be able to select, we have to be a bit mindful about what's important and what's not important. And be able to sort of engage with those things and sort of say, okay, you know, I hear you and everything else, but we have bigger priorities. Let's get to that soon, but you're in the list. You know, so at the same time it responds going, oh, okay, right, at least I'm acknowledged. It feels acknowledged. It feels Because that's, of course, one of the big things that human beings want, is they want to feel acknowledged amongst other people, because they're not acknowledging themselves. They're divorced from themselves, so they're looking for that recognition, that affirmation from other people. And yet we can find that in ourselves. And it's humbling, because when we see how big and how diverse and how complex and how amazing all this is, we can also see that we're not the monarch of this. We're not the CEO of this mind and body. It's running. The heart doesn't need us to control it to beat. The lungs doesn't need us to breathe, you know. And indeed, if you try and force your lungs to breathe and try and control it, you're going to have a pretty awful meditation, you know. If you try and control things, it just doesn't work. It's more about an engagement. It's more about self-respect. I'm saying, how can we do this together? And we start to become more, in a way, informed about how all this works, what our pain signals are, our mental and physical pain signals, this fight or flight response that's trying to resolve it but not able to do it, and on a much, much deeper level, the frustration and the anger and the self-hatred that we have because we haven't been able to do this. And yet at the same time, we're exposed to so much in society, all this advertising that never delivers what it promises, all these movies and superheroes that have adventures and happy ever afters, and why not me? Why can't I have this? And it becomes more and more disappointed and more frustrated. And we can calm that down. And we can sort of say, why? Why do we need to buy into this stuff? Why do we need to buy into all this advertising that's going to tell us that, you know, drink this or buy this and we'll be happy ever after? Who are they kidding? And this is the thing. We start to become more confident and more aware of the games our ego plays within us, but also the games that other people play. And that frees us up. Is that all of a sudden it's like, no, I don't have to buy into this. You know, somebody coming to sell, buy these shares and it will make you 3 times as rich, whatever, overnight. It's like, yeah, really? We don't have to buy into these scams that other people play, because we recognize the scams that our ego is playing on us, that's trying to get us to do all this stuff, that's trying to run away into greed, hatred, delusion, all this stuff, to get some happiness, to get some comfort, to get some fulfillment, but most of all, to get some security, to get some control, to be able to deal with stuff which is impermanent, stuff which is chaotic, stuff which is difficult and unpleasant. And this is the thing. Once we start to get a much, much bigger sense of what's going on, we can become so much more calmer. It's much like, we start to become more aware of bigger ideas in a way. We can start to think, well, in the English language, for example, all the beautiful human qualities are called selfless. Why are they called selfless? What makes these beautiful qualities selfless? Why is selfish qualities so ugly to us all? Why do we impulsively recognize somebody else's ego trip and go, ugh, and try to get away from it? But this is the thing. We have to get ourselves to that point where we can rationally look at this. Because if you say to most people, it's all about being selfless, most people would be getting pretty concerned about that, because they'll imagine it involves being some kind of, you know, disempowered doormat, at the slave of exploitation of other people's ego trips, and they're not going to be very engaging on that. But we look at it a different way and say, we're only selfish because we're trying to get control, we're trying to protect ourselves, we're trying to live in this world, and yet it isn't necessary. We can be more mindful, we can be more informed, we can be more educated, we can be more intelligent, we can be more active in what we do. We can be taking the decisions rather than having advertisers and scam artists and all the rest of it trying to tell us how to think. We can think for ourselves. And that's one of the big things in Buddhism. It's called aparapachaya, not dependent on others. And that's a sign your practice is moving in the right direction. But also, it allows us to think bigger ideas as well. What is it like to live a life that is harmless? Not harming ourselves, not harming others. Why do we harm ourselves? Because deep down we hate ourselves. Because we've lived such a disappointing life. Because all this stuff failed to deliver its promises. And we're frustrated. Why do we harm other people? Because we're frustrated within ourselves and we launch out at other people. What is it like to live a harmless life? What is it like to live a life of kindness and joy? What is it like to live a life where we give up these things which we don't need to run into? In Western thought, there's this very old story of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And for those who don't know it, the theory is you go to the end of the rainbow, you hike all the way to the end of the rainbow, and there's a leprechaun there, and he will ask you some riddles. And if you answer the riddles right, he'll give you a pot of gold. Well, most people are spending their lives trying to hike to the end of the rainbow, and at the same time, you know, studying riddles so they know all the answers and learning a bit of kung fu on the side that if he doesn't cough up, we can kick his butt. How many of us are doing that? And how many of us are doing that in Buddhism? We're studying the Zen riddles so we know all the answers when we meet the Zen teacher. How many of us are trying to, you know, kick the Buddha's butt and steal our enlightenment that way? How many of us are studying suttas and commentaries and all these texts so we can learn how to debate and enforce our view and our agenda as being the Buddha's teaching? There's lots of people who do that. It's very common. And yet at the same time, we can start to see, hang on a minute, the rainbow is just a trick of the light. It's a beautiful thing, but it's not real in that sense. We don't need to go hiking to find the end of the rainbow, which we'll never get to, and meet this imaginary leprechaun with his imaginary pot of gold, who's imaginary. It's all an idea. It's an idea that we've given ourselves to aspire to because we haven't been able to aspire within ourselves. We haven't been able to find that happiness and that comfort in ourselves and our confidence being in our own mind and body. We're looking for it outside, and yet we don't need to. And again, we can start to look at the bigger ideas. What is this thing called stream entry? Oddly, we never talk about it. It's all there. Oh, yes, this is something that you should be aspiring to and blah, blah, blah. What is it? And this is the thing. The Buddha says very clearly sort of how to achieve it, so to speak, because it's not really a thing. It's what you abandon. It's abandoning these three things called the samyojanas, the lower samyojanas. It's 10 altogether. But the three lower ones, if you've got a bucket list, they should be the things on your bucket list. Because the three samyojanas are the things that letting them go opens the mind up. And the first one is this identity view, sakaya ditti. It's this idea of having to protect ourselves, having to shore up this ego, this identity and everything else, and running around like a slave to it. The second one is called silabhata paramasa. Sila being habits. So we have good sila, is good habits, have good results, and bad sila is bad habits and bad results. But sila in this sense is doing things habitually. In other words, doing more of the same of what we're doing, expecting that's going to solve the problem. In other words, trying to get enlightenment through the things that are keeping us unenlightened, you could say. Trying to do the same things habitually without recognizing the root of the problem. And abhata is religious practices. It's basically trying to find some salvation through these one-size-fits-all beliefs and practices and techniques and meditation methods and all this kind of stuff that promise so much and deliver so little. And the last one is the doubt. The doubt, the vicikicca, which is a word which actually kind of means what it sounds like, you know, moving here, moving there, is difficult to narrate that one because it's something that at the beginning, until we started to look inside ourselves and see how all this works, we're going to have a lot of doubt and it's going to be daunting. But the more and more we experience this, we can see what's going on. We can experience it for ourselves and we know what this is leading towards. The way that I describe sort of stream entry to most people is the idea of a sandcastle. When I was a kid, they used to have these big, magnificent sandcastles in the shopping centres for public display. Really impressive things. Little turrets and windows and all sorts of things. And imagine that on the beach. And the waves gently come up and just ebb away at the foundation of that sandcastle. And eventually, the water erodes enough that a big chunk collapses into the water and dissolves. Now, the bulk of the sandcastle is still standing, but we can see, it's just sand all the way through. That's all it is. We don't have to worry. We don't have to try and convince ourselves of it being something other. It's just sand all the way through. And that's okay. And then more and more the water ebbs away and more of it falls away until we're completely free of it. And that's what the process is all about, is finding that happiness inside. It's to find that stability, that confidence inside ourselves, which is an act of self-respect. To find that peace, that happiness and contentment. And it just falls apart on its own. The waves are like wisdom, just gently ebbing away at these ideas that we shore up. And then we realize, they were just ideas. The rainbow was just a trick of the light. That's all. And that's very freeing. That's very calming as well. You know, we find so much happiness in this because we realize that this is one of the most rewarding things to do, because we don't have to run around anymore. We don't have to buy into these scams and cons and advertising, all these things that promise so much and deliver so little. And we can find that happiness within ourselves. And I think that's worth doing. So I've been going on nearly half an hour. Should we get into the meditation?
It sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. Beautiful. As usual, everyone, please stand up and give yourself a bit of a stretch. And adjust your clothing and do everything you need to do. Adjust your posture. And sitting half an hour, it's good to get that blood flowing a little bit. It's always good to set up the foundation of the meditation first. Sometimes we just try and sit and expect it to happen. And already by just loosening up a bit and adjusting ourselves, we're setting a good relationship with ourselves already. There we go. So, once we're in, you can close your eyes. And feel yourself settling into the chair, or on your bed, or on the cushion. And try to be aware of all the sensations. The sensations of relaxing, but also the messages that say, can you adjust this? Can you move this a bit? Can we be a bit more comfortable? And take those actions to settle in. And as you do settle in, focus on the breathing. What is it like to have a good relationship with your breathing? To be able to let the lungs breathe as they want to breathe. If the mind is trying to turn away, try to see why. Is there something uncomfortable? What message is it trying to send us that we're not listening to? See how we can be more engaged in the meditation itself. Imagine letting comfort and happiness and relief flow through your entire body and your mind. Now is the time we can be here. Keep checking the body and the mind. If the mind is trying to run away, why? Is it because there's something it is trying to get away from? And this is the time we can settle it. We can calm it down. We can be there for it. Are you still with us? Are you still in the present moment? It's okay if your mind runs away. We are not diminished as human beings for being human. It's perfectly all right. It's perfectly all right to relax and enjoy the meditation. And now our mind is calmed down. Perhaps we can imagine, what is it like to be able to send happiness, the wish for loving kindness to all beings? What is it like to be able to share that? What is it like to genuinely wish for ourselves to be happy? Imagine how vast that is. The mind of loving kindness, as vast as the sky, as vast as the world, as vast as the universe. What is it like to have a mind that big? A heart that big? What is it like to have compassion for all, with the wish for all to be free of suffering? And for ourselves to be free of suffering? How about joy? What is it like to have a heart filled with joy, filled with happiness? And to be able to be happy at other people's happiness? to celebrate their joy. Ready? You can open your eyes. It's all right. Well, I think you're muted.
Indeed, I am. Thank you. Yes, it is all right. It's very all right. Thank you.
Questions, bring them on.
Okay. Sky.
This guy?
Yes.
This guy. Well, I've had a lot of questions in my life. You spoke about joy, Venerable Sangha. By the way, it's always lovely to see you. I call you the happy monk. I enjoy your talks and questions and meditations so much. A lot of people see me as the joyful person because when I'm with people, I can manifest joy because I have a lot of energy. But the longer I study Dhamma and go within and try to sort out who is the knower and what is to be known and what is the citta, and I'm having a difficult time with joy right now because I can't seem to manifest a sincere joy in my own heart. I witness a lot of aging, sickness, and death, and on the news, of course, all over the world. It's not uncommon, only we see it so quickly. And I'm having a really difficult time to be joyful, to have cheerfulness when I'm alone. I'm managing without depression because I'm working so hard at stillness. Is there, the joy should come in stillness. And lately I can't even force a smile when I'm feeling this way, unless my cat is nearby. And for some reason, the simple act of touching my cat fills my heart with joy. So I know that joy still exists in me, but I can't seem to bring it up. I think it's the world affairs, maybe, and the aging of myself. And I feel sometimes I'm taking care of 2 and 3octogenarians, and I feel like when they're gone, then I'm going to be spent, exhausted. There'll be no more time for joy. So, but I want to have joy even on my dying bed. So just give me a little advice on grabbing joy and cheerfulness in a difficult period.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. No problem. The thing is, one of the things that we don't talk about very often is this practice called Chaganusati. Literally means recollecting the good that we've done. So it's being able to appreciate the good that we've done, because so many people in this world have very empty lives. The thing is that we're all trying to create a meaningful life, a happy life, a fulfilled life, and we're exposed to all this advertising, all these promises that, yeah, promise so much and deliver so little, and that disappoints us. It's hard to find joy and happiness when it is so unfulfilling. But from a Buddhist point of view, the only way that we're going to have a meaningful, happy life is to fill it with meaningful, happy things. We have to turn our mind that way. And the more we reflect, which is what this Chaganusati is, the more we remember the good that we're doing and the good that we've done, even if we've made mistakes, even if we failed, to know that our heart was in the right place, that we gave it a shot, that matters to the mind. That matters a lot. And a lot of the times we just block that out because we're trying to find the big fish in the present moment. And there isn't one. It's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And we're disappointed by this. A lot of the times, deep, deep down, we're still buying into this belief that everything will be happy, everything will be okay. But the reality is we have to come to face these challenges and to be okay with them, that this is a great big universe and it's billions of years old and it's not going to change for little old me because I'm not separate from it. And at the same time, you'll find happiness being with your cat or if you have a dog or anything else, because what signals is your cat sending you? It's happy to be with you. It's not asking for anything. Even if it's there purring away, you know, He doesn't care about what's happening and all these worries. It's just happy to be with you. And so we have to develop that happiness to be with ourselves. And by bringing that recollection of all the good that we've done and all the challenges that we faced, because these challenges, again, make life rewarding. That's what is so much about life. Many people are just spending it, wasting it in front of the TV, trying to escape from their own unhappiness. And yet, it is possible to find happiness in the present moment. But it doesn't necessarily come from joy. I mean, it doesn't necessarily come from stillness either. And that's the big thing. Stillness creates wisdom. It's sila, then samadhi, then panya. So doing these good habits to generate the stillness, to improve our meditation, to generate wisdom, to be able to bring the happiness and to see the happiness in the good that we've done, and to celebrate the good that other people have done. It makes this world so much bigger in a sense. That's what's so challenging about being on our own, is if we don't have this good relationship with ourselves, all it's going to try and do is to get away from the present moment, to get away from ourselves. And it feels bitter and resentful and not wanting to find happiness. It just wants to suffer. You know, why should I be happy when so many people are suffering in the world? Well, why not, in a sense? What good is it going to do us to be miserable? How are we going to improve our lives if we're going to be drowning in this unhappiness? And this is the challenge. That's what makes it so rewarding. So it's a big question, but hope this helps.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
May I?
Please.
Yes, it is. Thank you. It is sort of tied to what Sky mentioned, and also in continuation with what Ajahn has responded. I find it challenging to rejoice in what I acknowledge that I did right. So, case in point, yesterday I was mentioning at the beginning that I had a tough day yesterday because, well, the traffic is crazy and I like to follow the rules because I don't want to end up having an accident. So I stop at the stop sign, but not many people do that.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds really irrational, but after I started feeling really bad because the person who was behind me, he started yelling and I was seeing him from the corner of my eye shouting, and I turned my head because I didn't want to continue engaging with that behavior. So not just that, but other situations, like for instance, I used to work in hospital in the past. And sometimes it happens that you might, for instance, change the nappy of the elderly people, and unfortunately, they relieve themselves exactly afterwards. And I was one of those who wanted to change it again, because I always thought, well, what would I do if that person was my parent, for instance? However, my colleagues, they would tell me, no, don't start inventing new habits, otherwise we would end up working till the evening without having any break. And there were times when I did as they did, even though I knew it was not the right thing. So I don't want to go back there, because with hindsight, it just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
However, I still find myself in situations, maybe it's because out of a need for people-pleasing, in a way, but I have doubts when I do the right thing. And, you know, after calming down yesterday, I reflected on it, and I thought, well, you know, how awful it must be to be in the driver's position, where he is so caught up in being in a hurry that he is not taking care of the road signs and he's yelling at other people while driving.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to get around it in that way of feeling compassionate for the other person. And also after having a good night's sleep in the end, I can understand that I did the right thing. However, it still doesn't sink in completely. And when I talk about it to people who I deem wise or trustworthy, I feel that I sort of can increase trust in myself.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, part of why I have joined this group is that I feel that if other people's wisdom and right action can rub off me,
I think I can have more, even more trust in my right actions. However, I wonder whether you have some more advice to share, or how I can soften this maybe transition feeling until I start feeling I can feel trust in my right action and rejoice in the right things that I do.
Mm. Well, that's a very good question, because the issue often comes up that we're trying to do the right thing not necessarily for our own benefit. And sometimes we sacrifice our own happiness for the well-being of others. And that is a very noble thing to do, but eventually it has a cost. It wears down on us. And it's the same with other people, is that the way that they respond to the world is indifference. I'm in a hurry, I don't care about the rules, And if anybody gets in my way, then that happens a lot. The entire world is struggling in this situation because they don't have this happiness in themselves. And it does take a long time to develop. But again, it's celebrating that integrity, that even if it didn't work out, we gave it our best shot. We really had our integrity in the right place. And that trust and that confidence comes in on reflecting that. Why do we have to bring in other people's frustrations onto us? Why do we have to swallow their poison? It's their business. We have to be able to step back from other people's agendas, other people's frustrations and everything, because if we're already suffering, there's a famous story that of the shipwrecked sailors, and the first one is completely underwater and he's drowning, and the second one is trying to swim, but he's not going to win. They're not going to survive. They're going to drown. The next one has their head above water and they're swimming, but they're still a long way away. The next one has gotten close to dry land. The next one has been able to stand on their own 2 feet. And the last one is on dry land. They've been able to get out of the ocean of this problem, this complexity, other people's agendas and so other things. Being able to step back and say, hang on a minute, why do we have to buy into other people's poisons, other people's agendas? Doing the right thing is a wonderful thing, but we haven't yet found that happiness, that connection, because it's always kind of felt like it hasn't worked out. Like we tried to do the right thing and it still hasn't produced the change in the world where everything's going to be okay. But this universe is not going to be. It's not going to change for us. And it's to be okay with that. And when we are like that last person who's been able to stand on their own 2 feet and they're out of the water, it's because they've been able to let go of other people's business and to be able to focus on their own happiness and their own personal development and all these things. And that's the difference. Quite often, because we have doubts, we're trying to find answers from other people. And so we have to look inside and start being aware of how our own mind and body works. And that shows us the answers all along. There's a famous saying amongst hunters that the most dangerous animal in the forest is a wounded animal. And yet we're living in an urban jungle surrounded by wounded humans. And they're all trying to find some happiness, some freedom, some solution to their troubles. And yet all they end up doing is harming themselves and harming others because they haven't been able to find a solution. And again, they're surrounded by advertising and, economists and the news and politicians who promise so much and deliver so little. There's so much suffering in the world. It's to be able to recognize that in spite of all that, we can still find that happiness and peace in ourselves. We can find that integrity in ourselves. We can stand on our own 2 feet. So it's a big one. But we have to get ourselves to the point when we realize that this is the only thing really in life worth doing, to be able to stand on our own 2 feet and to not buy into other people's poison. So I hope that helps.
Yeah. thank you, Venerable. Could I read you something from the chat?
Yeah, sure.
How is it possible to not be lonely like a monk? And how do monks cultivate it? How can we develop metta and love to other people other than our loved ones?
Well, finding happiness in being on our own is sometimes a reflection of this is time that we can step back. This is time that we can be present. Because when we're with other people, it's going to be busy. It's going to be complicated. When we're with other people, we're automatically enforcing. We have no choice but to react that this is me, this is you, how I recognize you, what I remember about you, all these interactions stack up, all these stories and everything else. The moment that we can close our door, even if you don't have to be a monk or a nun to do this, you can go home, close the door and say, okay, this is some time just to let this stuff go, to be a bit simpler, to be a bit happier, that this is some time where we don't need to bring in all that stuff. It can wait. And that's a bit of what this challenge is about, because when we start practicing meditation, all these messages start coming in that the mind's trying to send us that we've been ignoring for so long and are often screaming at us, this needs fixing, this needs fixing, you know, do something about this. And we have to say, okay, look, I hear you, but not now. Let's calm this down. Let's settle. Let's find some peace and happiness. And then we can sort this stuff out. But right now, it's a time to be, to meditate, to be calm, to enjoy this moment, to be present and all these other things, to reflect on the happiness, to reflect on all the good we've done, because that's what gives us energy. If we're just living in an empty present moment, so to speak, where it's just one moment of suffering after another, where tomorrow is only going to be more of this, that's very debilitating. People commit suicide on the realization that tomorrow is only going to be more of the suffering they have now. And it's to be able to have that confidence in ourselves, to practice the skills, to be able to develop all these different things, to be able to be happy. And when we look at how people used to do this in the past, they used to practice art and music and poetry and sculpture and all kinds of things. All these things not as a coping mechanism, but as a way to calm the mind, to appreciate the present moment as an act of self-respect, as an act of delight. And there's no reason why we can't do these things. Of course, as monks, we have to live simpler. We're expected to close ourselves off from these things because that forces us to look within. If we're deprived from all these little treats and all these little distractions that we rely on, well, that forces us to deal with this stuff, or we run away into other distractions. We run away into building projects, into study, into socializing. We run away into so many other things because the mind is desperate for a bit of happiness. It's desperate for a bit of comfort. It's desperate for a bit of a solution. And we have to get ourselves to that point where we see, like the Sila Bhatta Paramasa that I mentioned earlier, that by doing more of the same things, it's not going to work. We have to change. And we have to get ourselves to that point where this is the most sensible thing and the most delightful thing to do. And then loneliness is never a problem, because life is so much more rewarding, because we're comfortable in our own mind, in our own body, in our own environment. And that's okay. So, again, a big question, but all these questions seem to be working together, so hope that helps.
Yes, indeed they do. Venerable, I have one more. How does one convince the builder of the sandcastle to stop repairing the sandcastle and to let the sand just be sand and not a castle?
Yes. It's because we need it. Because in ourselves, we're still so insecure within ourselves. We're still so uncomfortable with ourselves and still so uncomfortable in the world. We need it. We feel that we can't survive without it. This is one of these interesting things. When it happens with most meditation teachers and Dharma teachers and everything else, when they start talking about the five precepts or how we live as monks and nuns and all the things we have to give up, sooner or later they start to say, whoa, you know, what's wrong with taking alcohol? What's wrong with having sexual relations? What's wrong with this and this and watching the TV? And what that's revealing is that's the thing they're relying on. And that's the thing. We're constantly building up these coping mechanisms as a way to cope in the world, because we haven't reached that point yet where we can admit that this is how it is, that we're not separate from the rest of the universe. And it's not going to change for little old me. But that does not diminish us as human beings for being human. And it does not diminish us as human beings to share our own happiness with others, to share the light with others, to share our wisdom and help others as we can. It does not diminish us as human beings. Yet deep down we're afraid that it does. We need to investigate these things to be able to find, is this paradigm really worth following? Maybe there's another way. And to try another way. And so in these cases, it's a work in progress. But we have to start somewhere. And so, hope that helps.
I'm sure it does, Venerable. It's inspiring to think of starting somewhere. Is there anyone else who would like to unmute and ask a question? You'd be most welcome to.
Well, Chris, I have a little question at the end.
We would welcome you back, Skye. Thank you very much before for your question too.
Oh, you're welcome. I have so many questions. But how do we know we're not stream enterers?
How do we know we're not stream enterers? Well, that's an interesting question. The main point basically is that when you see for yourself that it is just sand all the way through, that's a huge life-changing moment. It's something that you'll never forget. And that's kind of the issue, is that on one hand, I mean, this is one of the differences between Theravada and Mahayana. The problem that the Mahayana see with early Buddhism is that they kind of believe that this is all about purifying ourselves and that we accomplish something called stream entry, that it's a thing, that we're like defiled grubs that have to go into a samadhi cocoon and emerge as a Buddha butterfly. Well, of course, it doesn't work like that. It's what we're letting go of. And so the Mahayana sort of say, well, we're already enlightened. And that's sort of true, but there's a bit of a problem with that, because if you buy into that, well, hey, I'm already enlightened, why should I care? It's all going to be fine. No. Someone tried this with Ajahn Chah, and I particularly like his answer because it's a bit, you know, it's well recorded. He picked up a tray and said, well, imagine this tray was originally clean and originally enlightened, so to speak, and then I go and dump some excrement on it. Is it still clean? Well, of course it isn't. Would you want to eat off it? No. And this is the thing. Generally, stream entry isn't so much a thing as much as these three samyojanas, this identity view, this addiction to doing the same old, and expecting it to all come all right when, you know, in other words, doing more of the things that are harming us, expecting happiness to come from it, and then investing in religious practices, expecting these one-size-fits-all techniques are going to solve everything. Seeing that it's just sand all the way through really eliminates the doubt. And so this is a big moment, but we have to, that's the thing. If you've got a bucket list, these are three things that you want to really investigate. And yet we hardly ever talk about them. And that's one of the weird things. So it's not so much if we're sort of invoking this, you know, am I a stream enterer? That's still a Sakaya ditti. That's still an identity view tucked in there. It can be very, very subtle, but we have to see that, hang on a minute, this is just another very subtle little way the ego is trying to carry on building up that sandcastle.
Okay. With the Sila Bhatta Paramasa, That is the definition of craziness, right?
Oh, all of Samyojanas are the definition of craziness.
Oh, you're making me joyful. Thank you, Venerable.
You're welcome.
And thank you too, Sky. Is there anyone else who'd like to get a last question in or a comment?
Can I get the last one in?
Oh, Gloria, of course you
can. Can you speak a little bit on feeling bored? Because I feel bored all the time. Like, I enjoyed playing. I in the past used to play piano like for hours because that doesn't make me bored. But now I realize that I still play sometimes, but it's like, I don't know. I think I know why, but I don't know. I just always feel bored. And can you speak a little bit on that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Boredom is another kind of loneliness. That's an interesting one. Our boredom is a way of saying that I just don't like the present moment. I'm not finding any joy here. It's a response that we have. Some people have indifference. Some people have loneliness. Some people have boredom. Some people try to escape into things. But this boredom is a complete sign that we're disconnected from the present moment. And we're disconnected from it because we don't have any reason to be there. In fact, this is a problem. If we don't, you know, see, we're trying to... The catch that we have as Buddhists is that a lot of us are trying to practice Buddhism to try and make the present moment be some kind of utopia. We're trying to find some magical way to make this all be all right. The thing is, it was always all right, but we haven't been able to admit that yet. We haven't been able to find the happiness in being in the present moment. And of course, sometimes that does mean stepping outside into the city or the forest or the garden or whatever's near you, into some park, and to see a bit of an expansion, to see something a little bit different. Because when we're so enclosed in our little bubble, in our little apartment, it can become a little prison because we feel oppressed. As human beings, we're used to walking. Traditionally, we've been walking for millennia and getting around and being under the open sky. And yet we're closing ourselves off from that and we're feeling dissociated, deprived, shut off, disconnected. We need to incorporate more of that into being able to enjoy our environment more and to be able to have more of a diversity of things that we enjoy. Because we're so narrow today, we're kind of forced into being such a small little bubble, you know, and this is who we are and da-da-da-da-da. Who says? Who says? Why do we have to buy into their stories? We don't. And so with boredom, it's a way, basically, of sort of saying, I want to be somewhere else. And sometimes at the beginning, it's good to be somewhere else. It's good to get out under the open sky, to be in a park, in a garden, maybe to go somewhere else and have some enjoyment, some happiness with someone else, do some quality time with someone else, not with an agenda. And the more we do this, the more delight we find. And then the present moment doesn't become boring because it's not so empty. Deep down, you know, Buddhism talks about emptiness and how everything is empty. We have a huge vested interest to get away from emptiness. We have to reconcile that one day. We have to come to terms with that. And the only way that we can solve that emptiness, this sense of meaninglessness, is to fill it with meaningful things. Things that are rewarding. Reflecting on all the good that we've done. Making quality decisions and being human. So it's an excellent question. But the thing is...
just one follow-up. It's like, is disconnect from yourself or disconnected from the present moment cause of boredom or both?
It can be both. It's often both. Yeah, they're in a bit of a loop, see? So we're bored, so we disconnect from the present moment and the environment, and then because we're disconnected and bored in the present moment, we're bored again. We're unhappy again, and then that causes a new moment of disconnecting, a new moment of boredom, and so, oh, this sucks. That's how it is. We kind of have to break that cycle by sort of seeing that we don't have to keep on doing more of the same. We can go and, you know, try something a bit different. So we can interrupt that cycle. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah. is it the chitta that is constantly needing something to do to feel alive?
Ah, now that's a good question. We constantly...
Next time.
Well, no, why not? We're constantly trying to feel alive. That's why people try and, you know, they go bungee jumping and skydiving and take LSD and alcohol because they're trying to feel more alive. They turn the volume up on their sound system and listen to movies at 120 decibels to try and feel more alive. We eat spicy food because it incites the tongue and everything else. We're trying constantly to feel more alive. And yet that's another way we're just trying to escape, you know, because
right.
we're, yeah. You see how that works? It's brilliant, isn't it? The things we do. And that's the thing, is that the more we enjoy our present moment, the more alive we feel, because we're connected with the present moment. We're happy being in our own, we're comfortable being in our own body and mind. We don't need to turn up the volume and listen to the doof doof at 120 decibels. We don't need to watch ultra intensive movies and all these things to try and excite us, because we don't need them. We're only looking for them because we're trying to fill that hole, to feel more alive, because we haven't admitted in ourselves that we are alive and that we're wasting our life. We haven't admitted that yet. One day.
We have one more, if you have time, Venerable. Is that
yes.
Okay? Can I read it from the chat? Okay.
Of course.
You. So sometimes in your mind, or you're just like when something happens that makes you mad, you're planning on not being mad, but when it comes to reality and when it happens, you end up saying something, and then after you realize you shouldn't have done that or said it, and you should, or become mad about it. Any advice on how to avoid the situation and stay calm?
Ah, well, this connects right back to the beginning, doesn't it? Is that deep inside, our mind is launching out because it's going wild, it's going crazy. Those five precepts help us be more stable. Being more mindful helps us be more aware. And we're more, not in control, but we're more engaged in what is good to do and what's not good to do. And we can make that choice. And again, this is anatta. Sometimes stuff just comes out. And sometimes it's all these pent-up frustrations where we just finally see that person and pew, you know, we explode. And yet, that's what's happening. That's all it is. We're not diminished as human beings for making mistakes, for having this body and mind doing its thing. It's coming back to see, okay, this is not a good way to do things. Exploding in people's faces is not ideal. So let's find some other ways that when people confront us or are in that difficult, then we can step back a bit and say, hold on a minute, let me just, you know, I'll talk to you in a few minutes, but I just need a bit of space. Is to find essentially a bit of an exit strategy. And that, all of a sudden, is what skill building is about. How we can mediate, how we can manage, how we can be a bit of an internal diplomat, how we can resolve these situations is not only being inventive and creative and effective, but that brings us so much confidence that all of a sudden we can manage this stuff better. And all of a sudden we don't feel like we need to explode because all this stuff is pent up inside. We found new mechanisms to be able to deal with this stuff. And that's really what the joy of all this is about, is finding these different skills, finding these different ways of living a good life and not being essentially the slave of these internal processes and everything else, these instincts, these needs and wants. It's to be able to engage with them. Because when the heart and the head, wisdom and compassion, aren't working together, it's disjointed. And this is where all the problem can come in. So again, it's a big job, complicated, but we've got to start somewhere. And it's worth doing.
Well, thank you very much, Venerable, and thank you for spending this evening with us. We've had over 42 people here this evening. Would you be so kind as to offer us a blessing to finish the evening?
Of course. Nati me saranang anyang puto me saranang warang ete na satya waje na sotite ho tu sabada. Nati me saranang anyang damo me saranang warang ete na satya waje na sotite ho tu sabada. Nati me saranang anyang sango me saranang warang ete na satya waje na sotite ho tu sabada.